Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman after a very eventful week 7 in college football. Bruce, a little bit later on, we're going to have a special guest, Trent Dilfer, who everybody knows from when he was on ESPN every week, or certainly when he was an NFL quarterback, but we want to talk to him. He's Mr. Elite 11, and we want to talk to him about some of the great college quarterbacks out there who he knows very well. But first, I think we need to talk about some significant developments for over the weekend, including one that caused me to change my number one team in the top 10 this week. For the first time, when I went to do my top 10 Saturday night, it actually required quite a bit of brain power. The basic question was, after LSU's 42-28 win over Florida, do I move them to number one in the country because of their resume, or do I stick with the, well, here's who I think has been the best team so far, which to that point had been Ohio State. I did move LSU to number one in the country. I think they deserve it after the wins over both Texas and Florida. You don't have a vote or you don't have a ballot of any kind, but if you were doing one, would you have done the same or no?
I would have. Look, we're going to get to see, my Fox Sports crew is going to get to see Ohio State Friday night against your alma mater in Evanston.
I wouldn't read too much into that one.
No. But look, I think we're getting at right now is Ohio State has not faced anybody, through no fault of their own, have not faced anybody quite at the at least ranking level as what LSU has seen, both at Texas, which was on the road certainly, and look, Texas now has two losses, against Florida. And I think those, you know, fortunately, this is the great part about our sport, at least in this case, is this stuff, this part of it is all going to sort itself out. LSU's still got to play Auburn, and then they're going to have to go to Tuscaloosa. And somewhere in there, you know, they play some other good teams too, and eventually, if they keep winning, they're going to go to the playoff. And so I think that, you know, what creates an interesting situation now, though, is LSU, as rough as their schedule is with some heavyweight teams on it, if they beat Auburn, you can look at it and say, even if they don't beat Alabama, which has been a huge issue for LSU for really most of this decade, they'd be sitting there at 11-1. If they can win at Mississippi State, which they should, and beat Texas A&M, it's not a stretch to think they're in really good position to be in a playoff spot with the wins they already have. And if they beat Auburn, I mean, we're just at the midseason point right now. Is that crazy to think that?
Yeah, I mean, that Texas win becomes a pretty big, now it would have been really big if Texas had beaten Oklahoma, but even the other way around, if by chance Oklahoma slips up at some point but still wins the Big 12, and you know you're comparing those two one-loss teams, and they both have the wins over Texas, but then what have the other teams done on top of that? I mean, I'm looking at Oklahoma's schedule the rest of the way. They may play one ranked team the rest of the way, whether that's Baylor or Iowa State, but I don't think it's going to be much more than that. So then they would probably play a ranked team in the Big 12 title game. But before we start fantasizing about crazy playoff scenarios, I just want to take a moment to, first of all, you were the very first one on the Joe Brady bandwagon, right? I mean, no disputing that. You were telling us all about him way back in February or March when you went down there in the spring. You wrote a big profile on him. But I don't think even you, right, would have seen LSU halfway through the season leading the country, averaging over 51 points a game. They just played an SEC game the other night, as I wrote in Forward Pass. That LSU in its history has played over 700 SEC games. And that night, the other night, was the most yards per play they've ever averaged in a football game, 10.6 yards per play. And they weren't playing Vandy, right? They were playing Florida, who has some really good players on their defense. Granted, two of the best ones were hurt. This is remarkable. Joe Burrow, a year ago at this time, was like a 52% passer who, okay, he's an upgrade over who they have, but he's still kind of a game manager. He's the Heisman front runner right now, And I don't think there's even any question about that, although obviously it's not like Tua and Jalen Hurts are slouches. I'm trying to think in my time covering the sport whether I've seen such a dramatic shift from one year, change from one year to the next.
I can't think of it either. I mean, look, and you mentioned Florida was down, one of their best D linemen, and then another one got hurt late in the game. I mean, LSU was also missing one of their best receivers, Terrace Marshall, in that game. And they didn't miss a beat at all. I mean, you look at the way they run the football. I mean, I think this is a big hat tip to Joe Brady for what he's done there, not just with the system and the pass game with Joe Burrow, but with those receivers. LSU had problems with the receivers dropping balls before. I mean, to see how far they've come, Ja'Marr Chase is probably the breakout star this year, at least in the SEC. And they're playing with a lot of confidence. What's different to me, and I feel like you gave me a hard time on this part where me, you, and Andy had that text exchange previews, and there was something I said in there, which, look, obviously I've spent a lot of time around LSU, and I know that staff pretty well. But one of the things that came up on my visit in the spring was when you see how Clemson attacks Alabama and how aggressive Brent Venables can be as a defensive play caller. I think what's interesting there is Clemson knows, hey, we're going to probably be able to score on these guys. We are going to score on these guys. Whereas whenever LSU has played them, it's almost like, and there was a game when when Jalen Hurts was the starting quarterback his freshman year, they went toe-to-toe with Alabama into the fourth quarter, and then Jalen Hurts hit a big run, and then that was it. It was a close game, but they still won. But it was almost like they had no margin for error because there was just no real true confidence in their offense. That has completely changed now. And I'm not saying they're going to go in Tuscaloosa and boat race Alabama. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they'll be very fortunate if they can win that game. But it is the biggest change I can remember, as you said, from a team that was going, by some people's accounts, from a Stone Age offense to right now. Their offense is as dynamic as anything we've seen in college football.
I saw our friend Chris Dufresne, longtime sports writer for the LA Times, now runs his own site. He made the point that LSU and Oregon, who we're going to talk about a little bit later, have completely reversed themselves. If you remember, they played a really high-profile early season game in 2011, opening game. And at that time, Oregon was the splashy blur offense team, and LSU was the defensive juggernaut that started Jarrett Lee at quarterback. And here we are, 2019, LSU is averaging 52 points a game, and Oregon is allowing like 8 points a game. They've held their last four opponents under 10 points. The other thing I think is important to note about LSU, I was at that Alabama game last November, not very long ago. It's not like they've completely changed over the roster. Their offensive line got absolutely mauled, and they got shut out. Quinnen Williams had a field day. Their offensive line against Florida could not have played better. And for all the attention on Burrow and the receivers, their running backs really had a great game that night as well. So now the flip side of all this, I think it's pretty clear six games into the season that this is not a vintage LSU defense. We first saw that against Texas, a little bit against Vandy even, who is terrible. And then the other night, I mean, credit to Dan Mullen. He is a good offensive coach. He has taken Kyle Trask, who, as every single TV broadcaster makes sure to mention, did not start in high school. And, they scored four touchdowns by early in the third quarter. They had three 75-yard drives. And then it was almost going to be 35. And then, obviously, the huge Derek Stingley interception in the end zone or at the goal line. So that was not a great performance by LSU's defense. And that gave me a little bit of pause about, should I really move LSU to number one? Because I know they've got this pretty glaring weakness as well. But here's the thing. Ohio State might too. I have no idea. They haven't played an offense that can test them. They've played Nebraska and Michigan State, teams that are not good on offense. I don't think that's the case. I think they have a really good defense. But the reason we know this is about LSU, why that defense has been exposed, is because they've played really good teams, and Ohio State and a couple others have not. So do you think, because the comments to that top 10 were immediately, so this year saying LSU is going to beat Alabama. No, I'm not necessarily saying that. Do you think a top 10 or whatever, top 25 should be predictive or
reflective?
Reflective. I think reflective. I think
it should be reflective. Yeah. I think because all this, you know, and then you get some of these, some of this kind of moronic, well, let's let Vegas, the Vegas handicappers.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, then what happened on the field didn't matter.
If we go solely by Vegas, we just skip ahead to the Alabama-Clemson championship game because.
Right. If you go solely by Vegas, then Vegas is going to pick Georgia to beat South Carolina again, and you can't just dismiss what happened. I have a question for you. This I thought about this yesterday at one point. You and I both did a ranking our top 25 head coaches, looking back. And I didn't feel like and look, I probably talked to Ed Ogeron more than anybody in the media. I did not have him in there. If we did this now, where would you rank him? I mean, because if you look since, and I did crunch some numbers on this, since 2016, I'm going to give you the list of active Power 5 head coaches who have a better winning percentage than he does. It's a short list. Nick Saban, Dabo Sweeney, James Franklin, Paul Chryst, and that's it. You could put Lincoln Riley in there, but he's only been coaching 3 years. So that's the list. Not a lot of other guys. Now, I'm not saying that it's as easy to win in Iowa City or in Ames, Iowa, or in Winston-Salem. But again, there's a lot of coaches who have big, big jobs who haven't won anywhere near this, including, you know, we're going to talk more about Georgia in a second. I mean, Kirby Smart, where did you have him? In the top 10?
That's where I thought you were heading into this, and you said when you brought up the coaches list, because you texted me something about Kirby Smart's ranking. Ogeron would definitely be in there. I don't know where. And one of the reasons to me would be he has done something that not a lot of head coaches are willing to do, and that's adapt. It didn't even just start with Joe Brady. From the time he took that job, he made it clear, I want to run a wide open offense. He didn't hire the right guys for it. Matt Kavanaugh, for whatever reason, that didn't work out. Now he's found his guy. It's what a lot of coaches try to do, but oftentimes they're too stuck in their ways, or maybe they're open to it at first, but then they clamp down. This to me is the definition of good coaching. He figured out what was the best fit or the best system for his talent. Now, before we go handing him the Bobby Dodd Coach of the Year award, I think he will ultimately be judged by whether he finally beats Alabama, whether he can, the LSU has won SEC titles and national titles in its recent history. If they were to slip up a couple times and go 10-2, I don't think they're going to be necessarily that thrilled about that. So let's see how he finishes out the season. But when you brought up the coaching list, yes, I thought it was going to be about Kirby Smart relative to Lincoln Riley, because you texted it, so you bring up the observation.
Yeah, so I remember this where it was, and they've coached roughly around the same time. And look, when it was in the Rose Bowl that Oklahoma ended up losing in overtime to Kirby Smart's team. I don't know how many people, you have to be the most diehard Georgia fan, I think, if you think that he's a better coach right now than what we've seen from Lincoln Riley, who I think is like 30-4 since he's taken over that program and had a profound impact there. And they feel like they keep getting better. Whereas the stuff I would say with Kirby Smart, and I'm not saying he's not a good coach at all, but he is loaded up on 5 stars, but you start to look at it. You know, I think a lot of people are taken as, wow, they went toe-to-toe with Alabama. They didn't win, but that is what I feel like a lot of people are hanging their hats on here and how well he's recruited. Whereas I remember last year, they went into Baton Rouge and got blown out of the stadium. They lost by 20 points. And to see it the other day where they're at home against a really mediocre South Carolina team that wasn't even 500 coming in there. South Carolina is down to their third-string quarterback, and they can't win that game. Now, credit to Will Muschamp, they found a way to do it. But does that make you rethink a little? You had Kirby, maybe sixth or fifth on your list?
Well, the thing at the time was the comments I got from Georgia fans about, remember, I think I had him top five, and then somehow that wasn't good enough. And you and it was almost like, well, wait a minute, he hasn't already won the national title. He hasn't already done the kind of things that I think you guys are just assuming at this point are going to happen. That's why I think this game this past weekend was so demoralizing. Yeah, you could spin it and say, technically all their goals are still in front of them, right? Turn around, beat Florida, win out, go to the SEC title game. If you win that, you're going to the playoff, just like they had hoped before the season. But that game was everything that every reservation that people have had about Kirby Smart to this point was confirmed in that game. And I think we can concede, right? Like, yeah, that list is a very simple, generalized, who's the best coach? But there's a lot of things that go into being a good college football coach. I think Kirby is an excellent CEO. I think he has done a lot of things that kind of modernized that program from Mark Richt's time to now. Obviously, a lot of it modeled after Saban. He is clearly a fantastic recruiter. He's just hoarding all these five stars. But he gets into these games when they're actually close, because they do have a lot of blowouts, and he makes some of the most baffling decisions, whether it was the fake punt against Alabama last year or the almost blowing that Notre Dame game with some of his management at the end of that game. So you were watching this game. What went through your mind when he called a timeout on 4th-and-1 when it was clear that South Carolina was about to let the play clock run out?
Yeah, I feel like Georgia fans, and you and I both know plenty of them, are probably sitting there, and for a long time, Mike Bobo was basically the scorn for them, and there was so much frustration. I can only imagine how many remotes were thrown at TVs at that point. It was just... because there was a couple of things that late in the game, nothing probably sets fans and sports writers off more than questionable clock management. And I think they're not operating in a vacuum, but you see these things like, oh my goodness, you know? And when stuff like that happens, you feel like eventually it's going to come back to bite you. And it certainly, in these cases, it almost always has. And, you know, go big picture on this. Like, it's been my belief that with the way Kirby has recruited and also with the way the SEC sets up, if I'm a Georgia fan and they don't win a national title this year or next year, and they're right now their odds to win a national title took a big hit after that loss because they have no more margin for error, I'd be really, really disappointed and surprised because everything felt like it's been trending in that direction. But now I think you have to question it a little bit and saying, I don't know, maybe this is just not going to go quite the way we thought it was just because all the five stars were rolling in.
Well, I think that they've built a program now where they have more talent than almost everybody they play, so they're going to win a lot of games every year. But to actually take that next step and win a national championship, which is what they want there, first one since 1980, there's a lot that goes into that, and these kind of moments. Look, they didn't lose the game on those decisions the other day. They still had a chance after South Carolina kicked a field goal in double overtime to go down and tie or win the game, right? So it's not like he cost his team the game with those decisions. But it just that and the fake punt and several other things, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence that this is a guy who could coach a team to that national championship. And they came as close as possible 2 years ago. But it just makes you lose it puts a little bit of doubt in your mind. Now, I can come up with a parallel for you. I feel like sometimes we've been covering the sport so long that whenever something happens, I can kind of just dig into my memory bank and go, oh, that reminds me of this. And maybe that dates me. I don't know. Remember when Mac Brown couldn't beat Bob Stoops and was Mr. February because he would always sign these, you know, number one, number two recruiting class and end up in the Holiday Bowl? And it's hard to imagine this now because nobody has any patience, but it took him 7 years to actually go to a BCS bowl. Like, they would win 10-11 games, but they'd lose to Oklahoma and one other team and go to the Holiday Bowl or the Cotton Bowl. It wasn't until Vince Young became Vince Young that they went to the Rose Bowl, and then they won the national title the next year. feels a little. I mean, Kirby already has done more than Mack. He already went to the national, won an SEC, and went to the national title game in week two in the second year. But I just remember at the time, I mean, Texas fans had no faith in him. Greg Davis was the object of scorn. This guy, he was their Bobo. This guy can recruit, but then he can't coach on Saturdays. So I don't want to throw in the towel on him just yet. Coaches grow, they get better. But how can your confidence not be shaken after that? And so far we've only really talked about the micro and not the larger thing of how did they lose to a 24-point underdog. Well, the biggest question coming into the season for Georgia, really the only question, I thought, you lost their top four receivers. It shows. I mean, they nobody could get open against South Carolina. That's how Jake Fromm ends up throwing three interceptions. Also, their offensive line, which people are talking about as the best offensive line in the country coming this season, is definitely not. They got all those great running backs, and they can't run the ball consistently. Do you think they will turn this thing around, beat Florida, have the kind of season we thought, or are they going to lose a couple more?
No, I think somewhere in the middle. I think they probably will beat Florida, but I think they will lose in the SEC title game. And if you do that, you're not going to the playoff, because I just don't think the resume is going to carry enough weight. They have a nice win over Notre Dame, and if they beat Florida, and that's a big if, then they would have that. But I just don't think – it wasn't like they got embarrassed by South Carolina. It wasn't like one of these Ohio State plays Purdue and gets blown out of the building, or plays Iowa where it's – you know, I think you mentioned this on the podcast a week or two ago. And I think it's a good point about when the playoff committee gets irked, it's not just who you lose to, it's if you get blown out in an embarrassing loss. And this wasn't that, but still, I just don't think they have any margin for error. For some reason, I think they'll beat Florida at this point, but who knows what kind of shape both of those teams will be in when they square off. As far as that, I don't know. I mean, to me, seeing this was like, oof, this is just because South Carolina was probably better than their record, but South Carolina is not that good. And again, they were playing with their third string quarterback. That's the part that's just like just a jolt to me on that.
Well, they played the entire second half in overtime with one hand tied behind their back, basically. Like, there was no way they were going to do anything on offense with him in there. So it was just, can Georgia score? Can they just get one touchdown at the end of regulation? And they couldn't do it. So that's on Georgia and their offense. And the inability to, you know, for all those five stars. I mean, Demetrius Robertson was a five star, but who has never quite lived up to that at receiver. He did. You know, the guy who's been their best receiver so far was Lawrence Cager, the Miami grad transfer. He had a big game against Notre Dame. He got hurt, I think, early in the second half. So, again, shouldn't have been in that position in the first place. So that was the most significant development of the weekend in terms of, wow, we finally had a top five team lose. But obviously Red River was the showcase game, or one of the two showcase games. And I thought Oklahoma, it wasn't so much that they won, they were favored to win, but the way they did it, after we just talked about the Joe Brady effect. How about the Alex Grinch effect? How about taking one of the worst defenses in the country last season, and a year later you're playing Sam Ellinger in Texas, and you get 9 sacks, and you hold him to one of his lowest passing performances of his career there, and despite Jalen Hurts having 2 red zone turnovers that you know might, if he hasn't had them, they probably win it going away, but they needed their defense to win the game for it, or help them win the game, and it did. And you know, that was their big question coming into the season. So now you've got a prolific offense. And I don't want to yet say like, oh, they're a premier defense, but they're definitely a lot better than they were last year.
I agree. They are. He's really changed the mindset. And I think Grinch will keep doing that. And look, their front seven got very active. Kenneth Murray was all over the place. Neville Gallimore, who's an old freaks list guy and has very talented, but production hasn't always been there. But they cut him loose and just let them guys go play. And when I talked to Grinch, one of the things he really stressed is to get them to believe that you can't be one allowing one big play is not going to break you. And so I think that's critical. And I don't think this is a case of, okay, we're going to say all of a sudden now this is an elite defense. I mean, as you said, I mean, they're definitely improved, but I think this is the kind of thing where they're going to have to keep proving it. And I think Alex Grinch knows that probably better than anybody. And I definitely felt like there was a gap between them and Texas right now. And I thought, I was surprised how much they bottled up Texas as well as they did. I mean, it was a rough go for Tom Herman's offense. I thought they would have been crisper, and they weren't. And that's a lot of credit to Alex Grinch for that and those players who have bought in. Can we transition to, we're talking improved defenses. I know you touched on this a minute ago, but with Oregon's defense, how much have you paid attention, and where do you think the Pac-12 is with having an outside shot at least to get in the playoff?
You've seen one of the most improved defenses up close 2 weeks in a row, and seeing is believing. I mean, Oregon, that game against Colorado the other night, now, is Colorado all that great? Probably not. But I didn't expect them to beat them, what was it, 45-3?
Yeah, and look, where Colorado is not good is on defense. They're really banged up, and they do not have a lot of talent, especially in the secondary or on the D-line. The part where Colorado has some guys is their receiving corps is really good, led by LaVisca and KD Nixon and Tony Brown. They have players, and when Steven Montez is hot, he's got a big arm, and he's played a lot of football. But they went after him, and it was bad Montez, and LaVisca got you could tell he was frustrated. And I think Andy Avalos, who did a nice job at Boise, has really fit in well there, and they keep taking the next step. And they got players. When you look at them, I remember talking pregame to one of the Colorado staffers who spent a lot of time in the SEC, and he kind of was eyeballing them, and he was like, they look like an SEC team. And they do. They may not quite have the numbers of an elite SEC team, but Javon Holland is a big-time defensive back. He would start almost anywhere, and you see it with the big D-line and linebackers who can run. It's impressive. Now, I don't know if they're going to make it without a hiccup somewhere the rest of the way, but they are getting a lot better as the year goes on, and I do think they deserve a lot of credit for the growth that group has made.
I mean, I was watching, and I felt bad for you because I knew everybody in America was going to turn off their TV very soon, because it was a close game early, and Colorado was driving for a chance to, what, make it 17-10? And then interception all sets up a touchdown. Colorado had four straight drives where Oregon intercepted them, and some of them were just insane athletic play. I mean, they were deflected passes, but Oregon was the one deflecting them. So, I mean, Oregon was the one making that happen. It wasn't like one of those flukish deflections off your own receiver's helmet or something. So that was a fast, athletic defense. Now, they're playing at Washington this weekend, and Washington has two losses, and they're probably not as good as they have been the last few years. But that's a big rivalry game that Washington really needs to. If they lose that game, they're done. They're not going to contend for the Pac-12 this year. If Oregon wins, they basically, I mean, they all but clinched the division at that point. They'll be at least two games up on everybody and three, obviously, on Washington. So I think that's going to be a really tough game for Oregon. And then the other thing I would say is, as good as Oregon's defense is, so is Utah's. So I think we're heading toward probably an Oregon-Utah Pac-12 title game. And whether or not Oregon wins this weekend, I'm kind of leaning toward picking the Huskies at home, but that wouldn't necessarily affect the standings all that much. And I don't know. I mean, you said talking about Pac-12 playoff team. I don't know. I don't know if that's realistic. And I also don't know that I'm sure who's going to win it. I mean, are you saying Oregon's definitely going to win it?
I'm not saying they're definitely going to win it. I like their chances after seeing them more and more. Their offensive line is very talented. I think now they hurt. I mean, Jacob Breland's one of the better tight ends. He has really been a go-to guy for them. And then he got hurt early in the game. Left the field on crutches. He's out for the rest of the season. They're going to miss him. Now, around the same time, they got three of their most talented receivers healthy. And so those guys are going to transition in. And Micah Pittman, I think, is a real stud, and I think he'll help them. But I don't know. I mean, right now I would pick them, but I don't feel that confident that they're going to go win in Seattle or that they can, that they would beat Utah definitely in the title game, but they're getting better. And you see some of that athleticism, that physicality is really translating. It's just, you know, I don't know if they can be that consistent. That's the part that I'm a little skeptical of, just because we've seen it from other teams. And I think the now the schedule gets rough. They've had it, they're relatively easy. I mean, Cal has a good defense, but they got them without Garbers at quarterback. They got them with Devon Modster, and that was a difference. And so keep an eye on the Ducks. It won't be boring, I'll say that.
All right, Bruce, let's get to our guest.
Trent Dilfer, Super Bowl winning quarterback, also the head coach of the Elite 11, has been in that role for a long time, so nobody has seen and worked with more of these quarterbacks that now we watch on Saturdays than Trent. He is also now the head coach at Lipscomb Academy in Nashville. Trent, thanks for joining us on the Audible today.
Always fun to be with you, Bruce.
I appreciate it. So look, you guys were the first ones to really, I think, have a grasp on just how special Justin Fields really was. I remember being out at Elite 11 a few years ago, and we knew he was a good baseball player. We knew he was at a big arm, and he was a big athletic kid. What was it you guys really noticed that kind of wowed you back then?
Well, I think what wowed you was the dominance in two sports, obviously baseball and football, the measurables, the height, weight, speed, arm talent, all that stuff. But then as you got to know him, and I wouldn't say we knew this right away, I think we grew to learn this and understand this about Justin, was his presence, just the kind of presence that he holds with coaches, with players, any environment he's around. He's kind of the thermostat. He's not loud, he's not charismatic, but everybody kind of draws into him and follows his beat. And then the precision for which he can play. I think people saw him, and I did at first too, as just a big physical athlete that could throw the ball hard. And as I spent time with him and saw him learn and grow and be coached, you saw that he can play with a high level of precision. He can process really, really well. He understands the passing game. He understands protections. He understands a lot of the nuance of quarterbacking that a lot of times great athletes don't have to understand, because they can just be the biggest, baddest dude on the block. And Justin has an awareness of those things and a thirst to know more about it. So he's really the complete package at every level. I've heard it said this way, game knows game. And everybody that has game knows that he has game, and that's why they kind of gravitate towards him.
Well, let me ask you this. So at your deal with the Elite 11, you guys throw some NFL concept at these guys. It's not just, hey, who can throw it the farthest, or a lot of 7-on-7 stuff. There's a lot of nuanced things you're trying to get them to learn. So as you've watched him on Saturdays now, certainly he started out at Georgia, and now he goes to work with Ryan Day, taking over for Dwayne Haskins, who had a really big year there. What have you seen from as he's made that transition?
Well, one, it's a perfect marriage, right? I think Ryan's offense is it's big enough, if that's the right word, to accommodate a lot of different skill sets. If you want to go straight NFL passing game and change protections and, you know, activate defenders and do all the kind of highly sophisticated stuff, Ryan knows how to do that. If you want to go straight high school and just play tempo and isolate bad defenders, he can do that. And you can do a hybrid of it. And I think Justin has the ability from a skill set standpoint, both physically and mentally, to do all of it. So it's a perfect marriage for Ryan, because he can do all the stuff he did with Dwayne. He can do all the stuff he's done with running quarterbacks. He can try new stuff. And it's just going to be the perfect marriage of coach, offensive, you know, mind and quarterback. What I've seen is a quarterback that's been really wise with the football. He's made his splash plays with his legs and his feet, but he's made really good decisions. And ultimately, you're going to be judged by the NFL by the quality of your decisions. And Justin's made really, really good ones. I think you're always going to have the ability to be explosive with Justin as a quarterback in the run game and the pass game. He's going to create space for you with your traditional run game. And because he's got a really big throw catalog, there's a lot of stuff you can do in the passing game. You're not just reduced RPOs or perimeter isolation throws. Like they're running high level concepts like we do at Elite 11, where you're working through full progressions, or you're handling a protection, a hot read, and then working into progressions. There's a lot of cool stuff they're doing with their offense, and Justin's executing at a really, really high level, which doesn't surprise me.
Trent, a guy that's been one of, if not the biggest stories in college football this year, is Jalen Hurts making the move from Alabama to Oklahoma. And I think you've got a pretty unique perspective on him because you go all the way back to when he was in high school and a finalist, and he gets to Alabama. In those first couple of years, people are saying, well, he's a great runner, but he's not a great passer. Now he's at Oklahoma doing both. Take us through kind of how you think he got from where he was in 2015 to now.
Well, and he's been a counselor for us for a couple of years in Elite 11. You know, out of all the kids in college football over the past years, all the Elite 11 kids, I think the one I've grown to admire the most, his competitive temperament, his soul, his leadership, is Jalen. He's a guy that is truly, truly authentic. He's a team first guy. He had this incredible freshman year. Well, number one, he's grown so much as a player and as a person, and we can get into that. But first, just the substantive part of him as a leader, like what he went through at Alabama to have the great freshman there, to lose his job to Tua, to be a great teammate, to come back as an Elite 11 counselor that year with Tua, the two of them together, and share with our kids what that experience was like and what it means to be team first. How he still had massive impact at the University of Alabama as a teammate, as a person on that campus, and now to go to Oklahoma as a refined player, but I think also a refined human. I mean, talking to him this summer, he was so laser focused on what he was going to bring to Oklahoma. He was not caught up in the Baker and Kyler stuff. He was not caught up in trying to be the quarterback that those guys were. He was completely focused on being the best teammate he could be, to go there and to compete, to go there and to take that team to a place they hadn't been before. And you're seeing it come out on Saturdays. Yeah, we could talk about how explosive a runner that he is and how he's added another power running game dimension to that offense. He's throwing the ball really well. His big play kind of sizzle reel was off the charts. But I think more what you're seeing when you watch Oklahoma is just the energy he brings to that team and the belief he brings to that team. And I think they're actually better than they've been the last 2 years. And I think it's not because their quarterback's necessarily a better player, but he is a dynamic winner and leader.
From his personality, you know him. I remember being in the room when he spoke, when you're talking about him being a counselor and Tua's in the room. And I remember sitting like probably a few feet behind Tua, and he's kind of nodding his head when he's seeing Jalen kind of explain himself. And unlike most of the guys there, I don't see him as a kid. You know, like in your head, you think, oh, college kid. It's almost like you default to saying it. With him, even when he was 19, he carried himself like he was a grown man. I don't know if it's a seriousness, but there was something there, a substantive piece of it. But just being around him, we did his UCLA game, and I talked to him earlier in the week. There is a burning desire there. It's very close to the surface with him about how competitive he is. How do you think he manages to walk that fine line where he's being driven in it, but yet he's not kind of popping off in a way where he's going to talk about it in a certain way? Like he has a degree in public relations, and I think he has a real feel for that, but it's an interesting dynamic that he is the transfer guy and how he has managed this and how he's taken it and driving him.
Well, I think two things. I think number one, a word we probably don't use enough is wisdom. I think he has a lot of wisdom. Football wisdom, life wisdom, emotional wisdom. He just is a very wise old soul for his age. I think the other thing is he's a pro. Like you mentioned, he's a pro with the media. He knows he's very tactical with what he's doing. He's a pro when it comes to his work ethic and his preparation. He's a pro with how he interacts with his teammates and coaches. He gets it at a different level than most people his age. I even go back to when he was in high school, Elite 11 participant, and he didn't make the finals, but even how he handled that. He was definitely one of the best 11 football players, we thought, at that time at the Elite 11, but he just wasn't refined enough as a passer where we felt he could go to the opening and thrive, and he understood that. And I remember talking to him his freshman year in Alabama, and he was still working on he was professional enough in his approach to take constructive criticism and build from it and make sure he was going to become a better passer, because he knew that would be his ticket to long-term success. So there's just a, like I said, there's a wisdom to him and a professionalism to him that not many kids his age have.
Trent, another guy you know well is Jake Fromm. And we mentioned Justin Fields earlier. I think the two of them are going to be linked together for a while going forward. And unfortunately, we happen to be catching you right after Jake had a really rough game against South Carolina. And then, of course, when that happens, everybody says, oh, don't they wish they still had Justin Fields? But Jake has obviously had a lot of success there, and maybe surprisingly so to people coming out of the recruiting scene. You know, why do you think it is that maybe he has been such a good fit for Georgia, where at the same time we can concede that Justin is probably the right guy at Ohio State?
Yeah, I mean, they're different quarterbacks. I never loved the fit of Justin at Georgia. That's just my personal opinion. We stay out of that part of it, keep our opinions to ourselves at Elite 11. But I never thought that was a great fit, mainly because Jake was there. And Jake, again, is a unique person. He's a very gifted passer. He's got, you know, what I call NFL passing traits. He anticipates. He throws guys open. He's got high-level quarterback eyes. He sees, you know, boundary to boundary. Doesn't just see isolations and either-or matchups. He changes the tempo on the ball. He handles protections. He's a dynamic leader. I mean, Jake does a lot. This is why the scouts love Jake so much, because he looks the part of an NFL passer. I think you take Saturday as a grain of salt. He had a couple bad breaks in that game, too. I wouldn't put that whole thing on Jake Fromm. In their loss to South Carolina, he had some bad bounces of the ball as well. But I think it's interesting, and I don't know if we're going to talk about Tua, but, you know, one thing over the 10 years of doing the Elite 11 thing that we've really noticed and tried to identify at a young age is which guys kind of have this makeup, call it a competitive temperament, call it personality traits, whatever you want, however you want to package it, but this makeup that gives them something special, that allows them to be more than just of what they are physically. And you look at Tua, you look at Jake, you look at Justin, you look at Jalen, and all four of them stand out in the list of the 10 years of guys with kind of the most stuff, the most extra stuff, the greatest competitive temperaments, the most natural leadership qualities, the ability to bring people together, the ability to get the most from the least and the best from the best, the ability to overcome adversity, whatever, all these cliches that we talk about that are actually true. These are the four guys that probably at the top of the list, I'd add Trevor Lawrence into that. I mean, these guys have something more than their talent, and we always want to minimize it to arm talent or, you know, test scores or size or whatever it is. And usually what makes them transformational players is the soulful part of their game. And I think all of them have that. And Jake will bounce back just fine from this last game because he's unique in those areas.
Okay, you brought up Tua. We're seeing him do things that putting up numbers, putting up touchdown interception ratios that frankly we've never seen. Obviously, he's playing with just a tremendous set of receivers. What's the ceiling here? Is there a ceiling? Like, what's the next step for Tua in his development?
I think I don't want to make this a Tua thing. Tua is obviously, and I've said this since day one, he's the most unique quarterback prospect I've ever been around. And I go back to working out with Aaron Rodgers when he was at Cal, and you know, Aaron and I had a connection through Jeff Tedford, and I worked out in the offseason with him. And Aaron was even close, not even in the same conversation as talented as Tua is at this stage. Tua can do things that Aaron couldn't dream of doing at that age. Now, I'm not saying he's going to be better than Aaron Rodgers. I think that people did make that giant leap. That's what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying at this point of their development. Tua does things I've never seen anybody be able to do. Whether that's from how twitchy he can play the game, from his release to the way the ball comes off his hands, to his throw catalog, to his ability to create space in the pocket, to his poise. I mean, I can go on and on and on. He's simply the most unique prospect I've ever been around. His ability to learn, I think that's something that people don't give Tua enough credit for, is he's a gifted learner. I mean, he can change after one rep. He learns something after one rep. He's a guy that the sky's the limit because of those things. Now, what does he need to work on? Everything. I mean, I think, when he's going to play against Tom Brady next year, you got to work on everything. You're always evolving, you're always developing, you're always learning new things. I think the college game, as much as there is Saturday offense on Sundays, the pro game is still a lot different. There's still a lot more you have to handle at the line of scrimmage. There's a lot more nuance to the looks you're seeing and how you digest those looks and the decisions you make from those looks. So it's just going to be a continued evolution of the game mentally for him. I do think he needs to take less risk with the ball. I've always said that to him. Every time we've ever talked, I've told him, you still have a little bit too much gunslinger in you. He tries to make a play on every play. I think he'll learn that over time, that no matter, he'll make a ton of plays, and you'll see him do Patrick Mahomes, Brett Favre, Dan Marino, John Elway type things. But to win championship after championship after championship, and I'm sure Nick is telling him this, it's about the boring, monotonous things where you turn down those Superman plays and take the boring play instead. I think the more he learns that as a player, as he goes to the next level, the better he'll be.
All right, Trent, I want to transition to where you are now. I had worked with you for a while, and then we've seen you on TV. We've seen you certainly as a player in the NFL, and you take over a program in Nashville, Tennessee, Lipscomb Academy, that had won, I believe this is right, three games over the previous 2 years, and you jump in there now as the head coach. What has surprised you, if anything, about now that you're in it as a head coach, that maybe you could never have realized about coaching high school kids in this day and age?
We start with a softball, Bruce. Well, number one, I think that contextually, I had retired. I had kind of, faded off in the sunset, watched my girls play volleyball, and I realized that you're not supposed to retire at 47. I really lacked purpose. I really felt like I wasn't having an impact. I felt like I had a lot to give, and wasn't giving it outside my family. I had turned down the NFL and the college opportunities because I didn't want to hijack my family. And with daughters, if I had boys, I would have been coaching a long time ago. But with daughters, I wanted to, celebrate their careers and be around them and be able to take them to school and make them lunch and yada, yada, yada. This high school fit was the perfect opportunity to kind of give everything that so many people have given me over the years. And people now in the football space kind of take ownership for how much they know. Here's the next guru, and here's what he knows, and this guy's gifted, and here's what he can give. And they forget that all they have has been given to them by somebody else. Lincoln Riley didn't wake up and become a football guru, right? Many, many people gave him a lot of stuff over the years, and I've been given a lot. I've played for incredible coaches, Hall of Fame level coaches. I've had incredible position coaches. I've had incredible experiences in the game of football. I've had incredible leadership development guys mentor me. I've been around the best and the John Gordons, the Michael Gervais. I've had life experience, losing a son and raising a family and mentoring young people. And life has given me so much. I feel like this was the perfect avenue to give it back. And that's really what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to create a human development program, my mass is a high school football team. And we're doing it. There's bumps in the road. It's challenging. To answer your question more specifically, there's a lot of monotonous things I didn't expect, but they're important because they impact kids. And I think the more I get to know where a teenage boy is in life right now, the more I appreciate the gravity of this job. Because of the world we live in, because the exposure to so many bad things that can sit on your phone, and these kids are exposed to because all the distractions, because of the pressures of life, because of the messaging. These kids are going through a lot, and I think they need to be surrounded by a bunch of men and women. We have a lot of female coaches too that are going to pour into them. And I've tried to develop the best high school staff in the country to pour into these boys and give them everything we can possibly give them in every walk of life. And in doing that, try to make them better football players and win football games. And it's been truly, I can say this without any hesitation, outside of raising a family, being married for 26 years, has been the most rewarding and challenging thing I've ever done. I'm only 8 months into it. I got a ton to learn. But at this point, I'm exhausted and exhilarated all at the same time.
That's very cool. Well, we appreciate you joining us today on the Audible and dropping a ton of insight, especially on, as I said, you've had more perspective on all these quarterbacks than anybody I know, and I think our listeners heard that today. So it's been fun to reconnect with you. And
can I leave you with a little note that our friend Joey dropped on me today, and I'll give him all the credit. It just blew my mind. Think of the crossroads of these quarterback transfers this year. And maybe you guys have talked about this. It's the first I've kind of thought through this after Joey handed it to me. You know, Jalen, everything he's doing has his eyes on playing Alabama in the college football playoff. But then you go to Joe Burrow, and everything he's doing, his eyes are being able to play Ohio State in the college football playoff. Oh, yeah, Justin Fields at Ohio State, all he's thinking about is being able to play Georgia in the college football playoff if they can bounce back. I think there's an amazing storyline here that Joey's pointed out to me on these kind of where these quarterback transfers, all the success they're having, but really what's in the back of their mind. When they lay in bed at night and they look at their ceiling and the lights are off and they're alone with their thoughts, you know that is all they're thinking about, that they're motivated every single day to get up and give their best because there's got to be something deep in their soul where they want revenge on those teams.
Yeah, I mean, look, they were talking about ultimate level competitors. I mean, you feel that with Jalen Hurts. You see it with Joe Burrow, and I think with Justin Fields, you know, in that position as well. So, I mean, look, that is a huge subplot to not just the season, but the Heisman race and everything else with it. So, again, I'd encourage people to follow you on social media. It's at Dilfer Dimes, D-I-L-F-E-R-S. Dimes. And Trent, best of luck on the rest of the season at Lipscomb.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. And we appreciate Trent Dilfer for joining us on the Audible today. Stu, more good games this weekend, which we will break down in a couple days in our Audible Extra. Any other things we should be telling our listeners?
Well, we didn't get to any mailbag questions this week. We ran out of time. So we will definitely hit them on our Thursday episode, the Audible Extra. That's on the Athletics app. We will also be doing some picks on that episode. And Bruce, I should probably talk to you at some point this week about all the fun things you can do in Evanston this weekend before you go cover the very, very, very lopsided game that is going to be Ohio State Northwestern.
Just tell me you're going to be tuned into FS1s too.
I will be tuned in for as long as I can stomach it. I will at least make it to the halftime interview. I'll definitely want to see your halftime interview. Which will don't you always interview the winning coach, the coach who's in the lead first?
Yeah, but that's not on camera. It's usually coming out of halftime where we do our on camera. So.
Oh, so I got to stick it through the halftime show.
You got to stick through the halftime.
All right, I'll do my best. We'll see you guys next time. If you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review us. It helps get the word out. By the way, you can also find The Audible now on The Athletic. Go to theathletic.com/theaudible. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme music is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can find their music on Spotify, wherever you get your favorite music from. Follow me, Stu, on Twitter at SLMandel. Follow Bruce at BruceFeldmanCFB. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to The Athletic. You can try it for free for 7 days at theathletic.com/free trial. We'll talk about it for years.